Yeah, so I guess this is the not exactly the first Petros Jurnaeus gave some similar talks, but it's starting a long sequence of talks on the use of randomized algorithms in numerical linear algebra, something that's sort of recent, not exactly new. They're started in the 80s. Many people have worked on it, and we'll see some of that work during this talk and the upcoming talks. I want to mention ahead of time that Ida Liberty and Pergun and Martinson are giving sort of complimentary talks to these on Monday afternoon. So those will be helpful in seeing what making sense of all this. So during this talk, I'd like to, and the one following this, I'd like to discuss three problems. So these are three things that you'd like to do in numerical linear algebra. So the first is verifying that the spectral norm of a matrix is not meaningfully larger than desired. So in many cases, you may have, say, one matrix and try to approximate it with another matrix. And then you would like the matrix that is the difference of these two matrices to have a small norm. If it has a small norm, it's a good approximation. If it has a large norm, it's a bad approximation. Presumably, you're interested in constructing good approximations to matrices, so you'd like to verify that that would be true. And we'll see a randomized method for doing this, which has many advantages over the classic deterministic ones, and we'll see what that is. A second task in numerical linear algebra is one of the most common. You want to do linear least squares regression. That's what statisticians usually call it. You might also refer to this as just solving over determinant systems of linear algebraic equations in the least square sense. Okay. And we'll see that you can do this more efficiently to a certain extent using randomized algorithms than the classic deterministic algorithms did. And the third is another important topic in numerical linear algebra is the lower rank approximation of the matrix. And this is roughly equivalent to computing several of the greatest singular values and corresponding singular vectors of a matrix. Okay, so point three, statisticians will recognize as principal component analysis. Okay, and we'll see that randomized methods for doing this have many advantages over the classical methods as well. So here's an outline of what we'll be seeing in at least my two talks and another one a month from now. So we'll discuss right now during this hour points one and two. And I should mention ahead of time, this is work that I am not connected with, but feels very useful and certainly worth knowing about. And then I'll start discussing point three with the next self-contained tutorial talk, a little more of an advertisement for some of our recent work. Then finish up a month from now with another talk during workshop two. That one's also self-contained, and that's on very much ongoing work. Okay, so as I mentioned, there's many people that worked on this, sort of starting with Dixon in 83 and finishing up with some stuff that we've been involved in. I think some of our members of the audience here have been involved with this. Santosh Vimpel show up a little later. Petros Jurnaeus is probably here somewhere. At least he'll be in residence soon. Let's see, anyone else? Ida Liberty's there in the audience, and so is Pergun and Martinson. So many people have worked on this, and it's been a long story in the development. Okay, although you see it became quite a bit more popular since about 2000. All right, so first I'd like to look at that first problem that we saw. That's how do you estimate the spectral norm of a matrix? Okay, so as I mentioned, I'll just reiterate it right now. Suppose we have construct an approximation to a matrix A, A to a given matrix B. That's a common thing that we'd like to do in scientific computing and many other areas of applying matrix computations. So we'd like to determine efficiently if the approximation is good, particularly if we cannot afford to access all the individual entries of the difference matrix. Okay. in many circumstances, you're given a matrix B, not by its entries, but by a method for applying it to a vector. Maybe applying its transpose to a vector too. In other circumstances, as we'll see in, I guess during workshop two, sometimes you'll construct an approximation, which you can apply fast, but you cannot access its entries rapidly enough. Okay, so there are circumstances in which B you can just apply to a vector. There are circumstances in which A you can apply to a vector. In either case, D equals A minus B. The only option you'll have in those circumstances is to be able to apply that D, or maybe its adjoint, to vectors. Okay. So what do we need? We need an algorithm for ensuring that that spectral norm of that difference is not going to be too big. Otherwise, our approximation is bad. We'd like to assure that the approximation is good. All right, and the method for doing this, I'll shout out what the name of it is. It's modified power method. Power method with a little bit of randomization thrown in. We'll see that if you apply D star D, so D could be a rectangular matrix. D star D is a square one, clearly. It's also self-adjoint. So if you take D star D, apply the kth power of that to a normalized random vector. I'll specify what that random vector is in just a second. And then if you take the Euclidean norm of the result of applying that matrix D star D to the K to a normalized random vector, then you'll get a decent estimate, as you would expect by running a power method, to the spectral norm of D to the 2K. Why 2K? Well, we applied D and D, and its adjoint K times to the vector. And in fact, we'll show and prove shortly that the probability of missing this, the probability of success here approaches 1 exponentially fast as k increases. And more to the point, this probability will be independent of what the matrix A is that we're looking at. It will not, so power method, probably most people are familiar with convergence results depending on what the matrix is, particularly depending on gaps and singular values. These randomized methods work independent of the gaps in the spectrum of the matrix that you're trying to estimate its spectrum. So this was originally observed via remarkably simple calculations concerning the surface area of a band around the equator of a hypersphere. So that's kind of wordy. All I mean is this. Here's your sphere. Just look at the area of this thing. So people who deal in measure concentration inequalities and stuff, they're familiar, the area of this compared to, say, the volume of the ball gets very small. That's the basic measure concentration that we'll be using here. If you don't know what measure concentration is, that's fine. It's just what's on the slide. So in any case, by looking at the area of this strip around the equator of a hypersphere, Dixon, way back in 83, showed the following. So I'm just going to go through this calculation. It's very simple not exactly straightforward. So let's define omega twiddle to be a normalized omega, omega over its spectral norm, where omega is an n by 1 vector, so a column vector, whose entries are normal 0, 1 random variables, so IID centered Gaussian random variables. So I said we were going to apply a matrix to a certain vector. This is the vector we're going to apply it to. This is our random vector. Omega twiddle is our random vector. Now, if you're given a self-adjoint n by n matrix C, then the probability that the spectral norm of C applied to omega is going to be less than what you would hope it to be, spectral norm of C by some factor mu, is less than some constant times mu, root m. Okay, so actually this does not look like such a great bound, but it says as mu gets smaller, then you're less likely to find that applying your matrix C to a random vector is going to result in a vector with a norm much smaller than the norm of C. So this is a first step in trying to estimate the spectral norm of a matrix. In some sense, applying C to your omega twiddle we'll give you some estimate of the spectral norm of C. Okay, it can't be very much smaller. And of course, it cannot be greater elsewhere. And now there's a trick. Okay, this estimate of the probability of failure is just first order. Whatever mu is here is mu over here. And if mu is a half, then you only get a probability not so small. So this estimate can fail. In order to sort of boost this probability, you do it k times over. And here, we'll just do it exactly explicitly. So if you're given any m by n matrix D, so D can be rectangular. Here I need the, C was a self-adjoint matrix, so it better be square. But our D here can be rectangular. And if you're given a positive integer k, then if you take and set C up here to be D star D to the k, you know, the matrix we were interested in applying during our algorithm, then, well, stick it in. Let's see, over here you're going to get D to the 2k. Over here you're going to get this to the 2k. And I just took 1 over 2k and replaced mu with mu to the 2k. Okay, so presumably everyone can follow how you get from line here to here. You're simply substituting in that C to the, D star D to the k. Okay? And now we get a very interesting estimate. Okay, this one's, well, actually sort of trivial. You just compute the area of this thing and compare it to the volume of that sphere there. Here we get something much more interesting, in fact. So note that if mu is, say, a half, then our probability still can be very small, even though a half's not that small. A half raised to some high power will be. All right, so, well, just concluding from that, we see that this number here, which is our estimate, or will be our estimate of the spectral norm of D, well, we see that, in fact, that number there, D star D to the K, applied to the mega twiddle, spectral norm to the 1 over 2 k power, it's not much less than D. You know, set mu to a half, then the probability approaches 1 exponentially fast as k increases. Okay. So again, if you had mu equals a half, then you're not less than half spectral norm of D over here with very small probability going exponentially to 0 here as k increases. All right, and of course, the spectral norm of D star D to the k applied to omega twiddle is always less than or equal to the spectral norm of D. Why? Just because our omega twiddle is a normalized vector. Okay. Yeah. Question? No. Okay. Yeah. So you know, just putting together these two lines here, we see that, well, D star D to the k, omega twiddle 1 over 2k, does give a decent estimate of D, spectral norm of D with very high probability if k is large enough. And observe, none of this had to, so this probability here on the right-hand side, well, it depends on point A, but that's a universal constant, and it depends on whatever mu you pick, set mu a half, if you like, and then it depends sort of on root n. But it does not depend on the spectral properties of your matrix. It does not depend on any gaps of singular values or anything like that. So the power norm, or the power method here, power method being simply compute this number, that is going to be a good approximation to D, independent of the structure of D, aside from one thing, the square root of m. Okay? And if you choose, obviously, if mu is a half, and you choose k great enough, then you can get rid of that square root of m.
But presumably you can get much better bound just above, like, you can get much better things than 0.8 times mu times square root of m.
Oh no! This bound is actually tight.
Just above.
Oh, just above. Sorry.
The concentration.
Oh, this concentration. No, this is actually tight. Except it's not 0.8. It's 1/√2π, which is 0.7954 or something like that. So this is actually tight bound. Yeah. But you can see what it is if you think about it for a second. It's simply the ratio of the area of that to that, and that this is. That is the calculation of that. Yeah, so if you want to eliminate this root n, obviously just take k as log n. Okay, but the point I wanted to emphasize here is that this estimate does not depend on special properties of D. That's very important, and there's not a known deterministic algorithm which has this property. Okay, so this algorithm always works for any matrix, and there's no such known deterministic algorithm where I could say the same. Now just a few comments for people who have heard about the power method before. Probably most people have. What I've just defined is actually the modified power method. And so technically what we just showed is that the modified power method with a random start does provide a decent estimate of the special norm of hyperbole. You can do similar estimates, as you would imagine, for the classic power method and even for the Lanczos method to a certain extent. If you'd like to see that, there's a paper by Kuczynski and Wozniakowski again. That's about a little over a decade ago now. Their estimates are a little too complicated to give in a talk, but they are sharper. Okay. So you would wonder, why don't people use the modified power method? Well, in fact, the power method always works better. Okay. It's not quite as simple, though. Okay, so I had some request from Peter Jones here to discuss something about Johnson-Linnenstrauss, and this is coming up. So this is what we're going to call subspace Johnson-Linnenstrauss. I'm not going to call it. Thomas Sarlos calls it that. It's a good name. We'll see why. So let's suppose here that we have three integers, k, l, and m, and they are related in the following manner, that k is less than l. And actually, you should think of maybe the second equality is often very much less than m. Okay. Now, let's suppose further that R is some L by M random matrix. Again, we're thinking of L as quite a bit smaller than M in most cases. And R can be of two types, and then I'm going to give a whole bunch of equations that hold for both types of matrices. So one, it can be a random matrix just having IID normal 0, 1 over L entries, just Gaussian random variables there. Or two, it can be something a little more complicated, just taking and uniformly randomly selecting rows of the product of an appropriately normalized discrete Fourier transform and a diagonal matrix whose entries are IID drawn uniformly from the unit circle. So yeah, I should write that as a different names. So this being the Fourier transform, then you have the diagonal matrix here. So this diagonal matrix is just diag with some random numbers. Where each of these is just a complex random variable distributed uniformly in the unit circle. So they all have modulus 1. And then you take this product here and randomly sample the rows of it. Okay, how many rows do you pick? L. Okay, simple. This is R is sample version of the product here, and it's supposed to be L by M. Okay, so that's what that matrix is. Both of these matrices have this following estimate trivially. Okay. Trivially for the second matrix that I defined, not completely trivially for the first matrix. I think Goldstein and von Neumann showed that this is true for the matrix with Gaussian entries. Okay, so this is one of the key bounds that goes into showing that randomized algorithms for, say, approximation of matrices and for regression will work. Okay. This is not Johnson-Linnenstrauss. This is something else.
Sorry to be a pain again, yeah. But for Gaussian matrices, the bound is better than the least square root of m divided by l.
Yeah, that's true. That's true for this one, too. So that little twiddle ignores the l. The reason I'm doing that is because l, I'm sort of assuming, is very much smaller than m. So it's not that big. And here is what you might call a subspace Johnson Lynch truss limit. So I'm just going to state that it's true, and if we have time at the end of the talk, we'll go through and prove it. Let's see. If you have an M by K matrix U whose columns are orthonormal, and a real number epsilon, or just some small positive real number, then you get these following two bounds. When you apply R to U, then its top singular value is no bigger, or you know, equivalently the norm of special norm of RU is no bigger than root 1 plus epsilon. Okay, and 1 over the smallest singular value of RU, remember RU is going to be L by K, so the smallest singular value is the K, is no bigger than root 1 plus epsilon, same bounds as in equation 2. And this holds with high probability. What exactly that means, maybe Edel Liver will tell you about, and some others. And this holds, provided that L is, so remember K is less than L, for these bounds to hold, L has to be sufficiently greater than K. For matrices of this form here, where there's random rows, that's okay, randomly subscripted rows of the product of a Fourier transform and a diagonal matrix, then our current bounds require that U be sort of bigger than K squared. And the epsilon dependence for all Johnson Lynch truss things is bad, and it has to be. Edel Liberty is maybe striking down this bound, getting it, and Nero Lone working on getting this down. But that's what we have currently. For the random matrices with Gaussian entries, L has to be K plus a small constant. So that's very, very tight. And then I'll just mention that randomized regression, if you want to prove that it works, we're going to do that in just a second, you'll need these two bounds here. So I'm just going to quote them, and we'll prove it at the end of the talk if we have time. The randomized reduced rank approximation, or lower rank approximation, utilizes this bound 1 and 3. So it doesn't really need this Johnson-Lindenstrauss type thing. Or rather, it just needs that one. However, there are certain theoretically interesting bounds which do use sort of both the Johnson-Lindenstrauss things. And again, I call this Johnson-Lindenstrauss, but it's actually a subspace Johnson-Lindenstrauss for those who know what that is. Okay, so we had dealt with already our first problem, estimating the special norm of the matrix. Now I'd like to consider the second problem on our list. So that's linear least squares regression. And what is linear least squares regression? Well, here it is. So suppose that A is an n by n matrix, and B is an n by 1 vector. And here, think that m is much greater than n. So this is an overdeterminate system. We'd like to find an n by 1 vector x such that we minimize this spectral norm of ax minus b. So ax is about equal to b. It's ax minus b is minimal. This is least squares minimization. Now, standard methods for computing such an x, standard methods being QR or SVD or anything like that, is going to cost you n squared times m. Okay, so n is the small dimension again. M is the big one. However, Thomas Sarlos just recently, working on, so that's in 2006, and in 2005, there was some work that led to this by Petros Janaeus, Michael Mahoney, and Muthukrishnan. I don't know. Muthukrishnan, except Muthu is just an abbreviation for his last name. So they motivated some work by Sarlos, and Sarlos made a very stunning discovery here. Pointed out that X minimizing this other system. So we'd like to solve this system. Instead, we'll solve this system. Minimize RAX minus RB, where R is the random matrix of type 2. This thing over here that I keep referring to that we discussed previously has all those Johnson-Lindenstrauss bounds. Now let's see. R, as we saw, was it was L rows of the product of a discrete Fourier transform and a diagonal matrix. So why did we pick such a special matrix? Well, so that we can apply it fast to a vector. Okay. So everyone knows that you can apply the Fourier transform fast to a vector by the FFT or related algorithms. And so here we want to apply R to a matrix that has n columns, and we want to also apply it to an additional vector b. And you can do that in time, n m log l. You might suspect with the Fourier transform that it's n m log m, but there is a way to accelerate that. It's been known for a while. I guess Sorensen and Boris published it in the early 80s. In all, the computation that Sarlos recommends for minimizing, you know, trying to get a good solution to this by randomizing, he recommends computing RA and RB, and then compute X, minimizing RAX minus RB. Okay. Well, we know that the cost of computing RA and RB is just MM log L. Okay. And now this system is smaller. R now has only L rows, whereas A and B had M. Okay. So we've reduced the size, the number of equations that we're solving here in the least square sense. So the number of rows in RB and the number of rows in RAX is only L, whereas it was M before in AX minus B. Okay, and because of that, now we just take the running time here and solve the smaller system. So it's N squared M, but now M is L. Okay, so this is the new cost. And well, the obvious observation is that, well, this is often less than N squared M when M is big. Okay. Now, just to specify a caveat, what is L? What do you have to take it to be? Current theory requires L be bigger than N squared, but I've run examples of this thing like a million times and haven't been able to get a failure with L equals M plus 8. Okay, so there's a gap between theory and experiment, and hopefully someone can close it. What's that? Yeah, this works independent of the value of L. Yeah.
So it's safe to say it's not about 8 times N.
Yeah, exactly. I'll have to discuss that afterward. That's just a very subtle thing. Here we cannot prove it either. For the matrices which are not of this special form, for the ones that just have Gaussian random variables, we can prove it, but that is subtle. Okay.
So that's it?
Yeah.
I wonder how that connects with those results with Stochastic gradient that I was talking about earlier. Stochastic gradient basically is instead of multiplying the lines of that system by one matrix, just take a subset of it.
Yeah, well, this is related. This tells you what subset would be good to select. Yeah. Yeah. In fact, if you come to my talk in a month, I'll show exactly how you would choose a good subset. That's great. So, let's prove it. Why not? So Sarlos said that it was good. It does work well computationally. We'll see that in a little bit. But we can actually go through and demonstrate this. This is Sarlos's reason. So to show that RAX minus RB nearly minimizes our AX minus B, we define U to be a matrix whose columns are an orthonormal basis, a subspace spanned by B and the columns of A. And then we define this matrix T. So T is U times pseudo inverse of RU. Okay, that's what equation 4 says. Now equation 4, you immediately get, if you apply T to RU, you can just read off from equation 4 that TRU is going to equal U. Right? So T looks like some kind of inverse. In the sense that, well, U was just defined as linear combinations, an orthonormal basis of the subspace containing A, the columns of A and B. So this then implies this. Right? Anyone not see that? Great. All right. So here I want to quote that subspace Johnson, Lindenstrauss bounds. Again, we didn't prove them, but we did write them down in here. I'm just going to reiterate that. So recall that on one of our previous slides, we saw that if the number of L of rows in R is sufficiently large, then 1 over the least singular value of RU was no bigger than root 1 plus epsilon. Okay, epsilon here being a small number. And if you put together 4 and 6, then you see, well, the norm of T is going to equal the norm of this pseudo-inverse here, because the columns of U are orthonormal, and the norm of that pseudo-inverse is just given here by equation 6. Okay, so we get equation 7 just by putting together 4 and 6. And those are the two ingredients that we need for the following bound. So basically this whole slide shows that minimizing RAX minus RB is good enough to try to minimize AX minus B. So I would like to go through it because it's very concrete. So let's define X to be the n by 1 vector minimizing RAX minus RB, that smaller system there, the randomized system. And Y we're going to define to be the n by 1 vector minimizing AY minus B. Okay, so Y is the ideal vector. It's the best possible we can do in this least squares minimization. We're going to use X minimizing this randomized system as some kind of proxy for Y. Okay, and we'll see that, in fact, X will be good also, standing in for Y. So norm of AX minus B is not going to be too big. It's going to be comparable to the norm of AY minus B, which is the smallest possible. All right, so if we put together 5 and 7, I'll show when we use them. So equation 8 here, remember, let's see it. So equation 5, we had that TRA is A and TRB is B. So just sticking that in there, we get equation 8. TRA equals A and TRB equals B. And then equation 9 is obvious. Just pulled out the spectral norm of T. Equation 10 here, X minimizes RAX minus RB. Okay, Y doesn't. Doesn't usually. So you get this inequality. And then we saw that the norm of T was no bigger than root 1 plus epsilon. That's the last line there. Okay, now we defined this, this kind of strange vector matrix U, and I did that for a reason. Remember, U was spanning the space, or the columns of U are spanning the space spanned by the columns of A and B. Okay, so therefore, if you take any linear combination AY of the columns of A, then that's just the linear combination of the columns of U. Okay, so that's what that equation says. And B was just the linear combination of the columns of U. Okay, that's how we define U. Okay, so we get two vectors Z and C such that 12 is satisfied. Putting that together, so if you use 12 here, substitute it in, you get equation 13. Alright, and equation 14, we're just pulling out that's obvious, we just pull out the spectral norm of RU. And in 15, I'm substituting in the fact that U is a tall, skinny matrix and its columns are orthonormal, so therefore it preserves the spectral norm. So 14 to 15 is an identity. And then we just use 12 again. We have UZ, we know what that is. And we have UC, we know what that is. So we substitute it. Okay. And the whole goal of this exercise was to show that, well, we defined X as the minimizer of RAX minus RB. Okay? But that's not what we're interested in minimizing. We're interested in minimizing this thing. Right? AX minus B. And you see, if you put together all these and these, then AX minus B is less than or equal to root 1 plus epsilon times this thing. Okay. And remember, AY minus B is the best possible. Okay. So this whole string of equality says that AX minus B, our proxy, the residual for the proxy X, is sort of comparable to AY minus B, provided that norm of RU is not too big. That's good. Why? Because, well, another of our subspace Johnson-Lennestrauss bounds that I just stated there said that, well, exactly that. The top singular value of RU was no bigger than root 1 plus epsilon. Okay. That's same with equation 17 cents. So you put that whole string of equalities together here, like we just mentioned, and stick in this bound, then you get that norm of ax minus b is no bigger than 1 plus epsilon times the norm of ay minus b. We get, as it says, the spectral norm of ax minus b is nearly as small as possible. Now, all this, remember, we use these Johnson-Lindenstrauss bounds. Well, they only hold up to a certain high probability. Okay, they're not at they don't hold to the probability 1. So all this holds only up to high probability, and that is again provided that the number of L of rows in R is sufficiently large. And here again, X. The whole point of this was X minimizes the smaller randomized system, RAX minus RB.
But in these case problems, we don't really care about AX minus B, the norm we care about. We want to look at X. And
So if you were actually interested in how close is X to Y,
right.
Then of course you just go back to the classic things and ask, well, does A have a smallest singular value that's not too small?
Right.
And then you immediately get a bound. And of course, if A does have a small singular value that is too small, then you had no right for asking X to be close to Y in the first place. Yeah. So that's just trivial linear algebra to get X close to Y, if that's what you want. Yeah. The hard point here is always the backward error bounds. That's what this is. Or the norms on, or the error bounds on the residuals, which is what. Other questions? Or? Yeah. So let me just summarize everything we said there, just the thing that you need to know if you want to do computations. So again, constructing RA and RB, those randomized versions of A and B, and computing X minimizing RAX minus RB has this cost, n log L plus n squared L. And that's often less than the n squared m that you would need to compute directly using standard deterministic algorithms to compute Y minimizing AY minus B. And again, that holds when M is much greater than N. Now here I just want to reiterate a caveat that our theory and practice has a certain gap, and that's theory requires that L be greater than N squared, whereas L equal N plus 8 seems to work well empirically. Okay. Yeah?
So, you thought about using something like this for non-linearity squared?
Yeah, people are working on that presently.
Oh, great.
Well, I don't know so much nonlinear, but they're working in that direction, certainly, generalizing it to other things. I mean, the very first thing you might want to consider is why minimize least squares? You minimize L1 or LP, and people have. So I know Jernas, Mahoney, and others are working on that right now. So. Yeah.
Nonlinear least squares basically also kind of the sequence of.
We would like to push it in that direction. We're thinking in that way. Have not succeeded too spectacularly yet. Yeah.
If I don't want the whole vector X, but just want one component, are there faster ways of doing this?
That's a good question. I haven't considered. Yeah. Okay. I do want to show you what it does on the computer, though. Okay, so let's actually run this regression right now. Well, not right now. See what I ran it, and I'll show you what it did. So I'll define that M by N matrix A as the following here. It's a bunch of left singular vectors, right singular vectors, and here's the singular values. I've chosen to k exponentially. For any particular reason. And then the right-hand side here is sort of commensurate with the choice of our matrix. So it's a whole bunch of the left singular vectors plus one extra one. And here, all the u's are orthogonal, including this extra one, un plus one. And all the v's are also orthonormal. And I just chose these u's and v's didn't know what to do with them, so chose them to be just what happens when you apply Gram-Schmidt to a whole bunch of vectors with random normal 0, 1 entries. The vector x minimizing the norm ax minus b, in this case, you can write down exactly what it is. It's just the sum of those b's. And for that x, if you stick it in, if you stick in or compute what ax is, well, you see x is the sum of b's, and it'll just annihilate that there. And if you subtract off b, then ax will cancel this part of the b, and you're just left with this thing, which is orthogonal to the rest. So I just chose it that way. It's not important what it is, but the one thing that is important is that the norm of ax minus b, again, x is the minimizer, the norm of ax minus b is 10 to the minus 9, okay? Whereas the norm of a is 1, okay? So when we compute an x, we're hoping that it minimizes this residual to 10 to the minus 9, whereas our matrix is normalized. It has a norm equal to 1. So we're hoping to get some pretty decent accuracy relative to the norm of the matrix itself. We'll see a comparison of the randomized algorithm with classical pivot QR, the householder version. If you don't know what that is, just think of it as Gram-Schmidt. Special version is Gram-Schmidt. Okay. X fast here, I'm going to define as being the solution of the randomized method, fast because we can compute it faster than we could compute using the deterministic ones. And this, I'm going to define a delta fast being the residual of ax minus b encountered during 300 runs, and t fast is the average over 300 runs taken to compute x fast. And now I want to stare at the results. Okay, so ran it for a few matrices, ones starting out sort of smallish at least, 1024 by 8, and going up to quite big, 32,000 by 256, and the number of rows. So this is sort of that's the number of rows in our random matrix. Again, our theory required that the number of rows be greater than n squared, but you see here I'm not doing that. I'm taking L to be just a little bit bigger than n. Okay. And if you do that, well, if you run the direct algorithm, you get accuracies. Remember, the best possible is 10 to the minus 9. You run the direct algorithm, householder, you always get 10 to the minus 9. Okay. When you run this fast one, which we said could be within 1 plus epsilon of the best, then you lose a little bit, okay? So you're losing a digit down here at the bottom, okay? That may or may not be okay for your application. Some applications permit a loss of a digit accuracy there in some form.
So why does this grow with the loss of accuracy?
I have hypotheses, but it's not technically in our theory currently.
So if you're using this for, say, statistical estimation, then it's more than okay, because optimizing the objective function to death basically needs to overturn anyway.
Very true.
Yeah.
Another application in which this is okay is, suppose you're trying to use a least squares fit to build an approximation to a matrix. That's a common way. You have you want A times B equals C, but you can't get it exactly, so you minimize the residual in the least square sense. Then, if you're interested in nine digits of accuracy, and you only get 8, you say, well, okay, it's not that bad. Did pretty well anyways. Okay. So that's another circumstance in which it's all right. So if you can tolerate this loss in accuracy, then you get a benefit. Here's the benefit, is speed. So these are all the same things here. And this is the factor of speed up that you get on the algorithm. So for the small matrix, you get a little bit. But for the big matrix, you're getting a factor 15 times faster. Okay. So this is something that looks completely impossible to a classic numerical linear algebraist to have a deterministic algorithm, Gram-Schmidt. And you can do faster than Gram-Schmidt. 15 times faster, too. Okay, for a tiny sacrifice, a digit. I'll probably just skip that, just for people who are interested in computations. I was running all this in double precision. Ran it on one core of a modern microprocessor. That's sort of important because the method that I just described, we had to multiply a random matrix by all the columns of a input matrix. That you can do in parallel. Gram-Schmidt or Householder, you cannot do in parallel. So that was a factor of 15 on one core of a microprocessor. If you ran it on a quad core like they have now, you might get a factor of 15 times 4. Okay, so that's another very important aspect of this. The randomization allows you to parallelize. And that as we get more cores on our microprocessors, we're thinking that this will become a very important property of the algorithm. Of course, it already is if you're working on supercomputers or highly parallel computers. Also, I should mention that I didn't optimize this too much. I just used the standard FFT. This FFT is something like, I don't know, often 3 times slower than the best FFT Debian and things like that. Okay, so that was a factor of 15 without doing any special tricks. Let's see. What do you want, a 50-minute talk or an hour talk? Maybe you should have a question period? Or? I have no need to continue. It's I don't know.
You're sort of arguing with yourself now, so
gotcha.
But of course it's a good time to ask for questions.
Yeah, let's ask for questions first. Let's see if we want to go on. Yeah.
Some happen on the side of the statistics. What happens if you look at the maximum of the 300 runs of the delta class instead of the average? Are there outliers that sometimes the...
Oh, I doubt it. I mean, there might be due to machine circumstances, but you're going to see that with the direct algorithm, too. It's not really meaningful to do that. Sometimes you're... the pipelining in your Intel microprocessor does something strange for the iteration.
No, that's what my question is. Is sometimes you get some high residual. The residual.
The residual.
Yeah.
Ah, sorry.
Yeah, because you average over 300 runs, I see.
Yeah. These are the worst residuals reported over 300 runs. Yeah. So this is the worst. Yes, they are outliers. Most of the time you get better than this.
Yeah,
sorry, I was reporting a word, well, I mentioned it, but this is the worst case that happens. In fact, most of the time you get much better. You're not losing even a digit. Okay. Yeah.
So if you try, I mean, what results you get where if you set L to some fixed coefficient times N, like 2 or 4?
Yeah, we tried that too. You don't get a benefit over just additive multiple. The additive multiple looks like it's the... what God told us it is. There's a reason to believe this too, because for the Gaussian case, which we're trying to emulate basically, where your random matrix was filled with just independent IID normal zeros, zero ones, then we know that it is simply just an additive multiple, or just an additive constant. That we can show. Not for the regression, but for the lower end matrix approximation.
This regression that those results on sort of spectra or random matrix, I mean some of our products with sort of ID ID values.
Yeah.
Kind of the condition number, you know, gets better as I mean there's some sort of optimal number like 4 or you know, sort of 4 times more vectors in the dimensions.
Yeah, let me state this. Suppose you ran this randomized regression. Replacing our fast matrix R with the matrix that's just IID Gaussians, then L only has to be K plus a little bit. L has to be N plus a small constant. Okay. Now, I mean, it's not sensible to do that because you can't apply fast the matrix of Gaussian random variables. But we're trying to build a matrix which you can apply fast, which has that same kind of data. That's the idea. Yeah.
Yes. So what is the secret of this R equal N plus 8? Is plus 8?
Oh.
So if the
8 is not is something more than 5. 5 I had to say.
So what's the secret of 5?
5 is the one in which I could never get it to fail. So for the talk, of course, I set it to 8 because you might be able to get it to fail for 5, but you're not going to get it to fail for 8. Now I should mention that in the next talk we'll see that for these matrices that have Gaussian entries, IID entries, then if you have 20 extra ones, then the probability of failure would be something like 10 to the minus 17 if you're willing to lose a digit. Okay? So 10 to the minus 17 is not something that I can evaluate empirically. And that's why I never see it fail. Okay? When it's 8, the probability comes out to be something like a million. And it's for these big matrices, I can't run them a million times. Take forever. Yeah.
Do you know anything about the condition number of R, or is it relevant at all?
Yeah, it's completely relevant. Well, those are the bounds that we actually used, right?
Okay, so
it's not exactly the condition number of R. It's the norm of R,
okay.
And then it's the condition number of R U, where U is it's like viewing R through a subspace. So U, of course, is column span some subspace. But that subspace is only a small part of the whole space. Okay? So that's really what the meaning of this is. Yeah, so on the full space, you get this root n loss of, if that's coming up as a multiplier in your error bounds, then you're losing root n factor in your error bounds. Here, when you're viewing it on a small dimensional subspace, you don't lose that factor. You can get within 1 plus epsilon. Okay. Whether you want to do that depends on whether that small part of the subspace is actually a very small part, or if it's starting to become much of it. Okay. These bounds that I say you only need 5 extra or 8 extra, in that case, you're actually sort of filling up the subspace. Okay. So in practice, actually, we'd like bounds that are sort of more like this. For equations 2 and 3, and we don't really have them yet. We don't know quite what to do there. Yeah. We do have good bounds, but the computations indicate that better bounds are.